Welcome to the Who's Counting podcast with Cleta Mitchell, the podcast about America's elections. Hello, I'm Cleta Mitchell. Welcome to this episode of Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. This is a podcast about all things having to do with elections, how elections are supposed to be run, how sometimes they're not run the way they're supposed to be, and what we as citizens can do to make sure that we protect our elections. Today, we have a return appearance from one of my dear friends and one of the nation's leading lights on election integrity, and that is the Secretary of State of West Virginia, just reelected to another term, the Honorable Mac Warner. Mac, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you, Cleta.
So it's been a busy first part of the year in 2023 with some meetings in Washington, D.C. with various election officials. It seems like there were multiple meetings. And I'm pretty sure you were there to attend some of those meetings. What are these meetings that have been being held in Washington in the early part of this year?
Well, the most recent one was the National Association of Secretaries of State meeting, commonly referred to as NASS, N-A-S-S. And we meet twice a year with that organization. These are all the secretaries of state from around the nation, as well as election officials from around the nation. And we meet twice a year, typically in the winter, January or February timeframe. We meet in Washington, D.C. And then during the summer, we go out to different states around the U.S. To give us a flavor of what's going on around the United States. So we did meet in February in Washington, D.C., and we welcomed over a dozen new secretaries who have been elected in that the 2022 November election. So that was the main event, I think, was just getting these new secretaries on board and having them introduced to the procedures. And we look at various aspects. It's not just elections. We also get into some business world because many of us as secretaries also have the business licensing component and notaries and other jobs or issues like that. So we did cover a number of issues, but again, just welcoming those new secretaries, I think, was the main part of this year's meeting in D.C.
So are there some new Democrats and Republicans? What was the breakout? More Democrats than Republicans, or about equal, or what was it?
This time there were more Democrats newly elected than Republicans, but it's pretty evenly split. We have 20 some of each, Republicans and Democrats. And that's makes for interesting conversation. Sometimes we're looking for that common ground, but there are obviously some areas where we disagree. And at first, sometimes the conversations get a little bit more pointed. And there was a little bit of that during this session, but not too much.
Anything you want to share with us, or you'd rather not?
Well, I think it's what people can anticipate is that the Republicans are typically more in line with election integrity and getting after fraud and so on. And the Democrats are pushing for that access. They want to get everybody registered, and they want to make it as easy as possible. Sometimes without the security component, and that's where the conflicts arise. So I don't think there's anything newsworthy or startling about that, but that's how things sometimes tend to break down.
Well, and when I hear some of the bills that are being introduced into some of these blue states regarding elections, it's pretty unnerving. I think once Mexico and Minnesota come to mind, they're passing what we would call really bad laws, saying even one state, I can't remember if it's Minnesota or New Mexico, one of them has a bill pending that would basically repeal the statutes that say that felons forfeit their right to vote when they are convicted of a felony and sentenced to prison. And so they just decided to do away with the loss of civil rights altogether, and so they can still vote in prison. Talk about a captive audience of voters. That's I think that's what they're planning to do. It's pretty scary.
Well, and then these efforts to have non-citizens out to vote.
Oh, my God.
And there's always pushes to try to get 16-year-olds right to vote. Of course, the voting by mail and drop boxes, and there are just a whole host of things that it may sound okay to at first blush, but then when you look, is there anything that's keeping votes from getting into the system that are not proper, and there's that lack of security That's what really concerns so many of us who are interested in the integrity of elections. And ironically, or not ironically, but because when you think about it, it makes sense. When people have higher confidence in the elections, then they're more likely to vote. If you don't think that your vote is going to be counted or it's going to be canceled by an illegal vote or an improper vote, then people stay at home. And that's, I think, the worst form of voter suppression. The Democrats or liberals are always talking about voter suppression. The worst form of voter suppression is when voters lose confidence in the elections and they just stop voting. That's an untenable position. I don't think where any of us want to go, but that's where some of these initiatives by the progressives are leading us.
Well, I want to talk about some of the meetings and some of the narratives that I've read coming out of the NAS meeting and the National Council of State Election Officials and that sort of thing. There's still the narrative that people engaged as citizens, citizen involvement in becoming poll workers and poll watchers, that that is somehow a threat and that we have to all be on high alert against this threat. Now, that's what they said about the thousands of citizens who were trained and deployed as observers and election workers all over the country. And they kept saying that the corporate media, as Molly Hemingway calls them, just attacked me, attacked our organization, attacked all those citizens. And yet we didn't hear of problems and incidents at the polls. And yet they're still saying that citizen engagement is a threat to democracy.
What I saw and where I was disheartened was by the Department of Justice that made this threats to election officials as their number one priority. There was actually these phone conversations. Sometimes we get together on the phone, nationwide phone calls with NAS, these other organizations. And they put on some of these three-letter agencies, department heads, DHS, FBI, whatever, the Postal Service. And they've emphasized this threat to election officials. Well, the threats or the citizen engagement came when these election officials started changing the rules in the middle of the game. They started moving the goalposts. They started using drop boxes where it's specifically authorized by the state legislature. They allowed voting by mail, allowed the votes to come in after elections were over when state law said these votes had to be in by the close of polls, that sort of thing. And of course, people got angry and frustrated with that. And then all of a sudden, the Department of Justice said, well, we don't want people, you know, basically using their First Amendment rights to free speech and assembly and that sort of thing. It started calling these folks domestic terrorists and other labels, arresting people for using those First Amendment rights. So my solution to that is stop changing the rules in the middle of the game. If you don't like the election laws, go to your state legislature, do it through the deliberative process of a state legislature. Use Article 1, Section 4 of the U.S. Constitution as your guide, and that is that the time, place, and manner of elections shall be left to the state legislatures. That's how you change things. Not through a secretary of state or a county clerk or some other election official, or going to the courts and having a court determine what the rules are. No, that's not the way that our system is set up. But that's definitely what the progressives left is using to try to get judges to rewrite election law. And now is the time for us to go back, look at what happened in the 2020 election, the 2022 election. And if there are corrections that need to be made, let's do it through a deliberative legislative process.
Well, of course, you know what happened when Georgia passed its bill, Senate Bill 202 in 2021, and they tightened up a lot of things that had gone awry and gone wrong in 2020 in Georgia. And you saw the backlash of media corporations and all these in MLB, Major League Baseball, moving the All-Star game. And out of all of that, then Georgia had the highest voter turnout in 2022 that it had ever had. So all that Jim Crow 2.0, it was just nonsense. It was utter nonsense.
It was total nonsense. And that's the benefit of going back and analyzing what happened afterwards. And that the analysis is, you're exactly right, that the voter turnout became higher in Georgia. And there was higher confidence because Georgia had made these corrections. They saw that just sending out ballots and having people vote by mail and dropping things in ballots into drop boxes was not a secure form of voting, casting your ballot. And so when the legislature adjusted and made corrections to that, the voter turnout went higher in 2022. So you're exactly right. All that, it was nonsense. It was talking points. It was, let's try to influence elections by saying that having security is bad. No, what they found out is, like, voter identification, both sides, Republicans, Democrats, everybody wanted voter identification. And so their narrative was shot down, and the proof was in the pudding when there was a higher voter turnout.
So one of the things that you mentioned that you're on these calls, I want to talk a little bit sort of behind the curtain. You're a state official, Secretary of State, so you're the highest election official, highest ranking election official in your state. Tell us about some of these federal agencies that are involved in elections that people may not even really realize are that they are engaged in the election process. I'm thinking particularly DHS. What are they doing?
Well, DHS and then the FBI. And that's where I spoke out at the February meeting of NAS. I called out an FBI official. They were up there with DHS, as you just mentioned, or three or four of these panelists. And they were talking about what DHS was doing and FBI was doing. And they kept using the words disinformation and misinformation as a way of saying that's what Russia and China, North Korea, Iran are using against us. Well, I turned the tables back around. I listened to it as long as I could. I let it go the first time. But when I came back around a second time, I had to speak my mind. And that was, I've been highly disappointed with our own FBI. And I prefaced it by saying that I want to love the FBI. We do love the FBI here in West Virginia. We have the FBI Fingerprint Center in Clarksburg, West Virginia, and it employs a large number of people. It is located on Jerry Dove Drive. And Jerry Dove was a friend of mine from law school. I played basketball with him. And unfortunately, Jerry Dove was gunned down in Miami with another FBI agent, was killed. And so I have this particularly warm spot in my heart for Jerry Dove and what the FBI does. But when our own FBI starts using disinformation, and I use that word deliberately, disinformation is intentional misleading of people. Now, misinformation is just bad information, but might be a mistake or was it, derived through an artificial intelligence that was incorrect. But when you use disinformation, that is somebody intentionally putting out information that is wrong for the purpose of deceiving the recipient. Well, here it is our own FBI using disinformation against the American people with regards, I pointed out, the Hunter Biden laptop situation. Before the election, they purposely tried to squash that story. And in the misleading became when they had 51 former intelligence agents or officials like Brennan and Clapper and others signed a letter that said, this has all the indicia of a Russian misinformation or disinformation program. They didn't actually say that it was. They said it had all the indicia of a Russian disinformation campaign. Well, it was done to then get the news, major news agencies, not to cover the Hunter Biden laptop. Well, it was done right before the election with the deliberative purpose of affecting the outcome of our election. And that's where, as the chief elections officer of the state of West Virginia, I'm highly incensed that our own FBI would do that to us. And so I think we all need to be tuned into that. We see more of that occurring with the COVID-19, the Wuhan lab situation. Right now, Christopher Wray is trying to, the FBI director, is trying to do some cleanup after the fact. Well, we're several years after the fact. Where was the FBI on the front end of this? I think when they knew this at the outset or very early on, that this was a lab leak, but they've been silent now for way too long. And I could go on and on. The Hillary Clinton server situation back in 2016, where then the director, Comey, got involved at first saying that they were investigating, then calling it off, and then putting it back on and back off right before the election. This has a major impact on the elections, particularly when they change course after the early voting has begun. Let's either run the investigations straightforward, regardless of the election outcome, or do what we do with many of the election laws and changes and so forth. Don't mess with an election once we get within 90 days, but be consistent. Do one or the other. And so the point in all of this is our own federal government and these agencies, three-letter agencies, need to take a special account of elections because it is now critical infrastructure. Elections are on the same level of concern with our government as, say, Wall Street, our transportation systems, air traffic control, Wall Street, nuclear power plants, and so on. These are sectors. There are about 16 or 17 sectors in the American economy that are labeled as critical infrastructure. And now that our elections are part of it, we need to have, especially the Department of Justice and DHS, treating elections in an impartial manner. We should not be putting out information that favors one side or another so that the American people can decide the outcome of elections and not these three-letter agencies.
Well, I'm really glad that you spoke up and said that. And I'm curious, what was their reaction? Did they say anything in response or did they just look at you?
They did a nice pivot, a punt. The FBI official did mention
the subject.
Well, they mentioned one agent has been arrested or indicted for their role in that. But there are many more people involved than that one agent. That's where they pivoted, didn't address the situation. My frustration was my lack of confidence in the FBI, and I'm actually suspicious now of anything that the FBI does. And that's not where we want to be as either American people or in election officials, is distrusting our own FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and other agencies. They should be above the board, non-partial, and not bipartisan, but just non-partial. They shouldn't pick one side or the other. And right now, I don't have that confidence in.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've looked at is that this agency within the Department of Homeland Security, CISA, what is that, the Center for Internet Security Agency, yeah. Something like that. Is that what it's called?
But, the Center for Infrastructure and Cybersecurity Agency. It deals with computers and the cybersecurity of our elections, yeah.
But one of the things I've looked at is that they're partnering with a lot of so-called nonpartisan groups that are really left. They're really leftist groups. They're leftist nonprofit organizations who have a particular agenda with regard to elections. And it makes me very, nervous and concerned when I see my federal tax dollars being spent by an agency to partner with groups and entities that don't share my views. I just that want to shape elections in a certain way. And I'll give you an example. They're partners with something called the Election Integrity Partners. And this is a group of agencies and non-governmental organizations, including a couple of universities they've been engaged in deciding what is and is not misinformation or disinformation about elections. And so they would say and they have said in February of last year, DHS issued a heightened Homeland Security threat assessment about people who continued to say that there were problems in the 2020 election. As well as people who spread rumors about the sources of COVID. So,
I'm so glad you brought that up. And first, to get the acronym right, it's the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency.
Okay.
But you're exactly right. The issue becomes in all this is who gets to determine what is misinformation or disinformation. And when they saddle themselves up with these partisan organizations, then they start becoming the soothsayers as to what is true and what isn't. And what they've all determined, the political narrative, is that anybody that questions anything about the 2020 election is an election denier, they're a domestic terrorist, they're putting out misinformation and so on. It's all an attack on our First Amendment rights. That's what it comes down to. And I saw that at that mass meeting that one of their keynote speakers talked about trying to act like that she was a nonpartisan individual, but through the conversations when they started talking about censoring the internet, that's one of the big things right now is Facebook, Twitter, those. You saw the consternation that came when Musk bought Twitter and was going to open it up to where people could actually speak freely. And you saw all this huge pushback. This also gets into the social media and things such as Google and the search engines and so on, the artificial intelligence, the algorithms they use, what gets put up to the top of the search engines and so on. All of that is an effort to squash free speech. And so just as we saw with the Wuhan lab, initially, a few spoke out and said that this was a lab-created virus and it was a leak, then Facebook and Twitter and these others were shutting you down. They said that's misinformation. Well, we're finding out years later, even the FBI is starting to come out and say, well, yeah, it looks like that's what it was. Why were we shutting that down? And why was DHS and these other agencies, it looked like the FBI was saddling up with Twitter and Facebook to shut this down. Here again, I'm back to my discussed with the FBI and some of these other agencies. So the question becomes, who gets to determine truth? And it shouldn't be any one organization or a platform that says we're going to determine what's true and what isn't and keep it away from the American people. We all have this First Amendment right. I'm glad that you continue to exercise that. And even if we have to face ridicule from these social media and other groups, we need to continue to speak out for the benefit of the American public and our democracy.
Well, it is very concerning to me, and it makes me think that I'm hoping that the House Committee on the department that has oversight over DHS, the House Homeland Security Committee, I hope that they'll do some hearings and get an inventory of all the groups that CISA is engaged with and what they do and who are these people who are running things and that we're paying for. Because I do not like the idea of outside manipulation of the election system. And I was going to ask you something that has been along those lines. There have been some articles about connections and networks connecting voting machines across the country to the federal government. And honestly, I am not a technology person, but do you know what I'm talking about when they talk about Albert sensors and how these,
sure.
How can they be connected? How can voting machines be connected with the federal agency where they're not supposed to be connected, period? I don't understand that.
Well, you've brought two thoughts to mind. First, to address, I think, the question you're asking. An Albert sensor is something that is attached to a network that determines or helps identify when there are penetration attempts to get inside of a system, hack a system, that sort of thing. And so I'm not, want to speak out
like
against
it. It's like a burglar alarm.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. So I wouldn't be concerned about that being connected to the internet. That's their job, is to watch the internet, to watch what is happening. And what we did find in the 2016 election was that it appears that Russia did get inside Illinois' database, voter registration database, got inside of Arizona's and perhaps we're into some counties in Florida. But it took a number of years for all of that to come out. That was some of our concern at the outset was the federal government's role. And at first, they didn't want to embarrass election officials by admitting that these incursions had happened. And they actually withdrew data from the Illinois database. We found out about that because the Illinois election official wasn't shy about it. There was nothing that they did particularly wrong. It's when you have a nation state uses its means and resources to attack a particular state, that's really no fault of the state. They just happen to be a victim of it. And so fortunately, that individual shared that information with the rest of us so we could start defending our own systems. And that's what we pushed through the GCC, the Government Coordinating Council, where we shared data between the states, and we got the federal government to eventually completely reverse, to do a 180 on their not wanting to share information. And now we're required within a certain amount of time of an intrusion attempt to share that information with the federal government so they can get that out to other states to make a much stronger system across the board. Where I thought you were going with this, to shift gears a moment with the actual company called Connect, there's a situation out in Los Angeles where the company indicated that it was all American made and kept and so forth. And it looks like their allegations are that this was actually in China. Some of this information may have either been shipped to or stored in China and so forth. And there's a lawsuit pending about that. And I think we need to pursue that and not have a particular prosecutor decide to push that aside and not investigate. That's been my point with all of these things across the nation, because you see certain things happening in Georgia, other things happening in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona. We need to turn over those rocks. We shouldn't be afraid of an audit or looking at what happened and then correcting where we find these mistakes. And unfortunately, in I think Pennsylvania particularly, you had certain counties counting votes that came in after the election, other counties not doing that. There you have a discrepancy. That's not a fair election. We always talk about free, fair elections. We need to come up with systems where people on both sides of the aisle, Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals, whatever, are all competent in the system that we use and not have one set of rules for certain counties or certain states and other rules for others.
Well, and a good example of that is just this past year, you know, Georgia has that crazy law that, and it's the only one in the country that has this particular law. Louisiana has a sort of version of it, but where if none of the candidates receives a majority, 50% plus one in the general election, then they have a runoff several weeks later. And so that happened in 2022, where the Democrat and Republican neither of them got a majority. And so they had a runoff. Well, the Democrats read the law to say that they thought that the voting should be starting on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. The Republicans said, no, the law says it begins on the Monday after Thanksgiving. Went to court. Basically, the court threw it back. But by then, the Democrats had, in the three counties, they've started voting on Wednesday. They voted on Wednesday and Friday and Saturday. And the Republican county started on Monday. Well, that doesn't seem fair to
me. No, it doesn't. That's ludicrous. And that's a great example.
But that's what happens. And so I have figured out that you're never going to get judges to resolve something once voting starts. They cannot be counted on resolving controversies fairly, in my view. I haven't seen that being happening, but. You know, I want to ask you, Connick is a good example. It's a Chinese American who owns the company and represent and had contracts with all these election offices. And some counties around the country hired Connick to basically handle the data for all their paid election workers. So they had their bank information and their private personal identifying information, and come to find out that was all being stored in China on a server in China instead of promised in the United States. And then I learned that they have other products that they sell, services, one of which was to do inventories of all the election equipment, all the assets of the election office with schematics of the polling places and schematics of the election offices. And I'm thinking, and if that's all being stored in China, why is that a good idea? Well, that doesn't seem like a good idea to me.
It is not a good idea. And again, I go back to the elections being named as critical infrastructure. When we're dealing with critical infrastructure, we need to be dealing with American-made products, American-tested products, keeping everything American-controlled. And that's where I'm glad you brought this up, because elections are much more than just voting on election day. There's that whole lead up to the election day, then there's the tallying of votes, and then there's the process, canvassing, certification afterwards. And each one of these has different vendors that are involved, or a number of vendors that are involved. And so the vendors themselves have to be held to the highest standards. We need to set standards. That's what NIST is for, the National Institute of Science and Technology, and other agencies. They're American. We can rely on that. That's what DOD uses to make sure that our equipment, are the things that we fight with, our fighters and the jets, aircraft carriers, and so on, are built properly and don't have these bugs or problems built into the system, the computerization that did, the chips is what I was trying to get to, don't have these defects built into them, relay this information back to China. So we are dealing with critical infrastructure, and we need to do just what you're doing, and that's keep a watchful eye over all of this. And when we see it, call it out and not be afraid to turn over the rocks and see what's there and then correct it for future elections.
Well, you know, in that regard, Does NISTA have any jurisdiction over election equipment, or is that just the? I mean, I know that the Election Assistance Commission that was created after the 2000 election and the Help America Vote Act, they published voluntary voting system guidelines. They just published new ones for the first time in, I think, a decade. But they're voluntary. There's no there's no mandate, and I get that because, you know, we believe in state-run elections, but still certain standards need to exist. And I just wonder, could that be tightened up by states saying we have to adopt these guidelines and or something? Or how do you, you mentioned the GCC, Government Coordinating Council. What exactly has it done in terms of strengthening and protecting against cyber attacks and voting systems? And what do you think about the guidelines from the EAC? Does NISTA have any kind of oversight?
There we could do a full video conference on just this, but what we're dealing with is the EISAC. That's the Election Infrastructure Information Sharing Council and so on. So just as the other 16 sectors that I mentioned about being critical infrastructure, they have their own ISACs. This is where you share information between the states and regions as to what the best practices are, what the vulnerabilities are, and so forth. So now the elections is critical infrastructure. We have the Elections Infrastructure Sharing Agreement. And then the Government Coordinating Council is the government components where we share information with other states and election officials. And so after we did this GCC, then we set up the SCC, which is the Sector Coordinating Council. The Sector Coordinating Council are the deal with the vendors and to make sure that they meet the standards. So this was a 3 or 4 year maturing process to get these things in place. We were mimicking or mirroring these other election or critical infrastructure components of the American economy. So these things are in place. You mentioned the EAC, the Election Assistance Committee that is at the national level, and they do put out these voluntary guidelines. That's the start. And so what we do is by state, they can either say you have to meet the EAC guidelines or recommend that you do meet them. So you did point out that these are state-run elections. We want to keep them state-run elections. We don't want the federal government to take it over. But there are the best practices that put out, and that is adhering to the EAC standards or a NIST standard when they have tested election equipment.
So why, if that all that has happened, why was there so much conversation at NAS and the other gatherings about needing to strengthen and fight against cybersecurity threats to elections?
Well, from my perspective, the cybersecurity was indeed a huge component after the 2016 election going into 2018. We actually did have examples of misinformation and disinformation in each of those elections, some by Russians and then some by other and China, but also some homemade people who were just either pranksters or wanting to influence the election one way or the other. So there for 2 or 3 years, say up until the 2020 election and into the 2020 election, that was a major concern. But I think because there was such an emphasis on it, and some of this came out of the Belfer Center at Harvard, they actually were out there in front because the people leading that, now deceased Ash Carter, the former Secretary of Defense, and then Eric Rosenbach, who had been his technological guru at the Pentagon, saw what was happening. I think they had the behind-the-scenes perspective, and they saw what these entities were going to do in the elections to try to influence. They got out in front of this. It was very fortuitous that they did. West Virginia took part in some of the very first exercises, and we brought that exercise back to the state. We trained all of our 55 county clerks on this cybersecurity threat and what is the solution to it. How do you use double-factor authentication and other security measures? So I think by the 2020 election, I mean, you're always going to have that threat, but we had put the procedures in place, and we had like the Albert sensors. We were using our National Guard. All these went into, I think, putting a bubble around or a shield of protection around our elections with the ability to determine when these penetration attempts occurred and then how to rectify it. And I've pointed out, for me, the turning point was Soleimani was killed. That was the Iranian general was taken out by our drone strike. The day within 24 hours of that happening, the federal government had reached down to the states and said, be careful if there's a worm inside your system. This might be an appropriate time for the Iranians to turn that on. This occurred on a Friday afternoon after business hours. So I was able to get to my information technology director. He came in, he shut down our system. So if there was a worm, it would have prevented the leak from occurring. Within 3 days of that, West Virginia, Ohio, and Colorado all saw some unusual activity, penetration attempts. We notified the government, again, according to those GCC and the EISAC rules, we notified them of this unusual activity, and they put out within 24 hours warnings to all 50 states. So this was a prime example of, in one case, Soleimani, the federal government giving us actionable intelligence of something that may affect our election infrastructure. And then 3 days later, us sharing it with the federal government and them getting it out. So that was, to me, was a turning point that said, we have these systems in place. It is working. We are working together. I'll remind you clearly, right after the 2016 election, when the federal government named elections as critical infrastructure, there was a unanimous vote by the NAS secretaries to say, we don't want the federal government naming us critical infrastructure because of the concern that this was a federal takeover of our elections. But it was only after that was done under the Obama administration, when the Trump administration came in, Kelly, who was then the director of DHS, validated what Jay Johnson had done under the Obama administration. So we as secretaries saw this from both sides of the aisle, that the federal government knew something was happening that we didn't. And that's when we launched on getting security clearances so we could talk to our own federal government and have access to this intelligence. And that's why I can say now with confidence that with these protocols in place, with the security clearances in place for the secretaries, we have a much better relationship with the federal government. But we do have those concerns, as you mentioned earlier, say with CISA, DHS, DOJ being too tied in to partisan political operatives. And that's what we need to continue to work on to clean up.
You know, I'm really grateful for all of your insights and information sharing, because it takes some of the mystery out of a lot of this. One of the things that I've become increasingly worried about for 2024 is this, what we're calling Zuckerbucks 2.0. Remember that Mark Zuckerberg put $400 million of money from his family foundation into election offices via this organization, Citizens for Tech and Civic Life, CTCL. And they basically turned election offices in targeted cities and counties and battleground states in 2020. They turned those into Democratic voter turnout machines, and they drove up the Democratic vote using the election offices. And it was sufficient to change the statewide outcome and thus the electoral votes in several states. And then Mark Zuckerberg, so then a lot of states, 23 states have passed prohibitions against private funding. And yet we're seeing that was all done. Those laws passed in 21, 22. And now we're seeing an announcement a year ago by something new called the U.S. Alliance for Election Excellence, run by, guess who? Citizens, Center for Tech and Civic Life, CTCL, the same one that got $360 million from Mark Zuckerberg in 2020. And now they're running a program where they are, this time it's funded by the only known funder. There may be others. I think that's a big question. Who are the other funders? The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And we know that Bill Gates has close ties to China. And Microsoft was one of the very first companies, U.S. companies, to go into China. And now they're funding this through something called the Audacious Project. $80 million they've announced that they're going to put into targeted election offices. And they've already put money into Clark County, Nevada. They've announced it in DeKalb County, Georgia, which is one of the bluest counties in Georgia, that got a big bucket of money from CTCL in 2020. But the thing that is most disturbing is what they're asking these election offices to provide in return for their grants. They're getting access to proprietary non-public data about procedures, about the voting systems. It's really a lot like we were talking about the Connick contracts, where they're getting all this information, including schematics of the polling places and the election offices. And we don't really know who the money's coming from, other than the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, but we don't know who else. And we don't know where all that data is going, all that non-public information. And to me, it's like the Kansas City Chiefs paying the referees so they can be really good referees at the Super Bowl. I mean, why is this not something that outrageous? It just seems to me that this is something we should all be very upset about.
We should, and we are. It's an insidious process. And what CTL, what is it?
CTCL, what, yeah.
CTCL. And there are other groups involved,
yes,
in this. What they're doing is they're putting their thumb on the scale of our election system and using where we haven't, the laws have not kept up with technology.
Right.
And they saw a weakness. That's what Zuckerberg did. Used the front of COVID-19 as the front, saying we're going to use this money to get personal protective equipment and so on out there. And we saw exactly the opposite. Very little of it went towards PPE, and most of it went towards getting out the vote in these very blue areas. And we actually anticipated this on the front end because they actually did what they said they were going to do. Mark Zuckerberg actually said when he did this initially that he was using this money to go to historically underprivileged or under voting areas, which turns out to be what we saw. It happened to be a lot of these blue areas around key cities such as Philadelphia, Atlanta,
Milwaukee, Madison, the five Democrat cities in Wisconsin,
in key swing states. And so they got away with it one time. Now the states have reacted to numbers that passed laws, but we need to stay vigilant because it's just like what they did with H.R. 1, S.1, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, For the People Act, all these different names that are misrepresenting of what is actually going on. It's like a phoenix. It keeps rising from the ashes. It's not going away. Now we're seeing that with the funding of elections. Even though we try to say, we're not going to let you do that. By the way, West Virginia didn't take any of that money.
Good,
we actually called them out. We asked Facebook I sent them a letter asking for about 8 to 10 specific findings. What are you doing with this money and so forth? And they blew us off. They strung us out. And as the election got closer and closer, it was like, how many battles could we fight?
Right.
And unfortunately, they got away with it in a number of states. And my warning would be, a lot of election officials want money, need money for new equipment, that sort of thing. But you don't want to take tainted money, or there's no free lunch. You don't want to take money that then has the strings attached to it where you have to turn over information about your systems. It's a good idea just to keep private money out of our elections. It's supposed to be run by the government, and let's keep it that way.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mac, we would be a lot better off as a country if every state had a Mac Warner as its chief elections officer, because you've been so terrific. And talk a little bit about, before we go, talk about what you've done on cleaning voter rolls. That's something that people in America are really concerned about the nature of the voter rolls. And talk about what you've done since you became Secretary of State and what you might be able to share with others about how to clean their voter rolls.
Sure. It comes down to a matter of will. Do you want to clean your voter registration lists? And if you do, then there are various tools that you can use to clean up that system. And so when I came into office, the county clerks themselves told me how bloated our rolls were, that we had many people in there that had died, moved, and so on. So the clerks were willing, but my predecessor wasn't willing to provide them the tools necessary for them to clean the rolls. So I took that on day one, and within about a few years, we had taken off 365,000 names. Now, these aren't people. These are names off the list that had they stayed on, one, it just bloated the rolls. It skewed the numbers as to voter turnout. But most importantly, it removed 365,000 opportunities for fraud to occur, for somebody to vote an absentee ballot in someone's name or vote from the grave or whatever. And unfortunately, West Virginia has had a checkered past with voter fraud. Go back to the 1960 election. It was bought by John Kennedy over Hubert Humphrey in the Democratic primary And after they got away with it in West Virginia, they went and did it tenfold in Illinois. And that was a stolen election in 1960. Well, people bragged about that here in the state for a number of years. And even when I took office 30, 40 years after the fact from the Kennedy election, we had remnants of that. And we have now squashed that. What I did to answer your question is first you get those names off the rolls. Then you implement procedures to say, we're taking voter integrity seriously. If you commit fraud, we're coming after you. So we prosecuted a number of cases for double voting and other election fraud issues. We implemented a see something, text something measure where you actually use your mobile device. And if you see voter intimidation occurring at a poll or someone buying a vote or handing someone a bottle of liquor for a vote, you take a video, a picture, you send it to us. And I've increased our investigators fivefold since I took office. We only had two for the entire state when I took office. Now we have 10. And that's I put fabulous. Out my entire office on election day out at various polling locations. I've had numerous reports from poll workers that said, we've never seen somebody from the Secretary of State's office before until you took office. So that physical presence, it's much better to prevent something from happening, deter it from happening, than it is to fight the battle after the fact. So we just got out. We formed a task force with the U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI, and state police, using our Fusion Center. Interestingly enough, Cleta, we have 240 Fusion liaison officers. And these are people, just common citizens out there doing their job on a day-to-day basis. But they provide us intelligence if, let's say, there's a reported precinct down due to an election, an electrical outlet failure or a gas leak or that sort of thing. How do I know whether that's true or not? Unless I have on the scene validation of that. Well, this becomes a force multiplier for me as the chief elections officer, having these 240 people around the state who can report actionable intelligence as it's happening. So if you have the will to do this, you can find all sorts of measures to increase your election security. And with that, then you get increased voter participation. You have to get a public education communications going to let people know that this is happening. One, that tamps down anybody's desire to tamper with an election. And two, if something does happen, you get immediate intelligence. So those are just a few of the things we've done here in West Virginia.
Well, I think you should write a little guide. I'm serious. I think that you should document, here's the West Virginia story. Here's what we've done. And I will help you get it out everywhere. Because honestly, I think that a lot of what you've done, I think, is a lot more helpful than some of the topics I've seen discussed at NAS and some of these other places, because what you have is real world experience of how to really work with the local election offices in a way that makes them know that they're valued, but that they are going to follow the law and you're going to make sure the law is upheld. And that's really all the election integrity movement is about. Whatever else they may say about us, I just always say, we're people who are committed to following the rule of law. And if you don't like the law, just like you said, go back to the legislature. But you're a real hero. You're an Army officer, West Point graduate, and now you're serving your country and your state as Secretary of State. And I know that we're going to hear great things from Mack Warner for many years to come. So I appreciate all that you do. And thanks for spending some time with us and talking about some of these alphabet soup federal agencies that have their fingers in our elections.
Thank you, Cleta. It's been great being with you.
Always great. And that concludes this episode. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll share this episode and subscribe to Who's Counting. That's how we fight back against big tech censorship. So thanks for joining us. Let's help make our elections honest and lawful everywhere in America, just like in West Virginia. With that, we'll say goodbye. Thank you.
Thank you for joining Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell, the podcast about America's elections. Please help us fight big tech censorship. Like and subscribe to this podcast and be sure to share it with your friends. You can become part of this election integrity movement by signing up to join the Election Integrity Network. Go to whoscounting.us. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Election Integrity Network.